2 Kings today. So if you want to go ahead and start turning there. In 2 Kings chapter 2, a man stands at the foot of the Jordan River. His clothes are torn in two. His eyes are red, swollen almost shut from weeping. He has in his hand the coat of his teacher, which he takes and he strikes the surface of the water with it. And he asks, "Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? Where is the God who shut up the heavens so that it didn't rain for 3 years? Where is the God who answered by fire on Mount Carmel? Where is the God who humbles kings, who unseats nations? Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah?" It's a question that's posed by many today. It's posed by atheistic scientists in the lab. Death, time, and evolution is the answer to every question. We have people who have drawn pictures of apes becoming humans, so really we don't need God anymore to answer our scientific inquiries. It's posed on the silver screen by actors and directors, where our stories reek of postmodern sleaze, where our good guys in our films aren't really that good, and where the distinction between a movie and a porno has become more and more blurred. We've got our own ideas of what makes a good story, and we really don't need God's reality to help build our stories anymore. It's a story that's posed on our political stage by politicians and pundits, where separation of church and state has come to mean protection of the state from the church's influence and protection of the secular from the influence of the sacred. We don't need God to tell us how to run things anymore. We've got this. It's a story that's posed in our classrooms, in our grade schools, in high schools, in colleges, where our teachers and our professors are preaching a morality that is subjective, a gender that is fluid, where pronouns are cultural constructs. We have our own idea of authorities. You know, we can appeal to the academy. We can appeal to the university. And we don't need God as an authority in our life anymore. Where is the God of Elijah? It's a question that's even posed by seminary campuses, by liberal theologians. You know, where inerrancy of the Bible is questioned, where the supernatural is denied. You know, we have our own ideas of the real and of the true. Where is the God of Elijah? It's a question that needs to be posed by the church. And by the church, of course, I mean the people who regularly come and assemble, who believe in Christ as the Messiah. The people who assemble on a regular basis, the church. We need to ask ourselves these questions when we wake up in the morning. Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? When we sit down with our family to eat breakfast. When we prepare to go to work or head to the field. Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? We find the question in our text today. Last week, we ended the book of 1 Kings. We ended in chapter 22. And when we ended, we were really coming to the end of Ahab's life. It's a king that we've been following for a good number of weeks now. Ahab, the wicked king. And really, if you're looking at the books of 1 and 2 Kings, it's one book. Kind of like 1 and 2 Samuel is one book. And we've divided it into two. But for the sake of concept for y'all, if you're thinking of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, they're one book trying to make one main point. And the point, the movement in God's story that's being made in the books of 1 and 2 Kings is the failure of the kings to represent God. The failure of the kings to represent His desire. The failure of the kings to lead the people in righteousness and God's movement of the people into exile. So we saw it in chapter 11, most notably with Solomon, when the kingdom, everything is all set and he can represent the Lord and the nations are coming to Israel to hear about Yahweh. And then we saw Solomon's heart turn away. He multiplied riches, multiplied horses, most dangerously multiplied wives, and they led his heart after other gods. So God took the kingdom away from Solomon. He split the kingdom, and now ever since then, we've just been watching an increasingly bad train wreck as the kings go after these gods. Okay, after the Baals, or they've made up systems. Predominantly, we've been watching the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom of Judah has been doing okay from time to time, but ultimately, they're both going to wind up in exile. That's the movement of the kings. So today, I'm just going to read 1 Kings 22 because we're picking up a new kings. I'm going to pick up the end of 1 Kings 22. Since we left off with the death of Ahab, we begin with the succession of his son. His name is Ahaziah. You'll find him in 1 Kings 22, verse 51 through 53. I'll read it for you. Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria in the seventh year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And he reigned 2 years over Israel. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of his father, in the way of his mother, and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. So he served Baal and worshipped him, and provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger, according to all that his father had done. So the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree. Okay? One would think that the miraculous works of Yahweh during the life of Ahab would have made a little impression on Ahaziah, but one would be incorrect. Ahaziah wants to make his own way. He wants to do his own thing. And like many of us, he wants to learn from his own mistakes. Okay, I know that you guys messed up mom and pop, but I got this. No doubt he's a mama's boy. He's got his mother's eyes, and he's going to go looking after the Baals. Okay, he's going to follow right after Jezebel's desires. So when the story continues, just go ahead and flip over to 2 Kings chapter 1. We are told one day Ahaziah is walking around on the roof the roof of his palace, and this roof is going to be surrounded by latticework. And he falls through the lattice. He falls off the roof of his house, and he becomes seriously injured. Apparently, his contractors weren't following the law. Deuteronomy 22:8 makes a provision. They say, hey, you need to build railings around your roof so people don't fall off the roof and you suffer blood guilt because this guy's died because of it. But nonetheless, he's fallen off the roof. He's gravely injured. And while he's laid up in bed and he's considering his own mortality, he decides to send a messenger. Notice at verse 2, he sends messengers and says to them, go inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, whether I will recover from this sickness. So, in spite of the Lord's great victory over Baal on Mount Carmel, Israel's kings are still seeking after this false god. Even if it means they have to travel to a Philistine city. So he's going to this enemy city and letting them know, first of all, I'm weak and injured and I might die. Can you ask your God how things are going to work out? So he's providing a weakness. You know, the leadership in the northern kingdom's in trouble right now. But will you be so kind as to tell me whether we're going to make it through it? So they're traveling to a Philistine city. They're looking for truth from the enemy. Kind of like Saul, you might remember, when he goes to the witch of Endor to try to find out how things are going to go in the battle. And most likely this seer, she has a familiar spirit. She's consorting with demons to know the future. He said, well, are demons a good source of truth? Is that where I want someone to go if someone's going to tell it to me straight? No, they are not your friend. They want you to be in trouble. They want harm to come to you. They want you to die. And that's what happened to Saul, ultimately. But here, he's going to do the same thing. I'm going to go consult these pagan gods. I want to go consult demons to find out how things are going to go for me. He's looking for this false view of authority. Now, the angel of the Lord is going to appear on the scene. And he's going to come to Elijah, and he's going to have Elijah cut off these messengers and intervene. Notice it, verse 3. The angel of the Lord said to Elijah, the Tishbite, arise. Go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria and say to them, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Baal-zebub, the king of Ekron? Is it because Elijah's God is not present in Israel that you have to go seek a God in a foreign country? Where's the God who brought the rain? Where's the God who answers from fire? Is he asleep? Has he gone to the restroom? Is he no longer taking calls? Has he changed? And God tells the messengers, verse 4, "Thus says the Lord, you shall not come down from the bed where you've gone up. You will surely die." So he says, I know you guys are heading to a foreign country. Let me save you a trip. Spoiler alert, your king's not going to make it. So go back and let him know. And they do. They bring back the message to old Ahaziah. They get back. He says, man, that didn't take long. Why are y'all back so early? He said, well, we were on the way, making our journey, and we encountered a man, and he gave us this message for you. And they deliver the message. But notice something interesting about this. Is Ahab interested in the message? Verse 7, Ahab asks the men, what kind of man was he who came up to meet you, who spoke these words to you? He's not really interested in the message. He's interested in the man who delivered the message. I want to know on whose authority is this coming. No, I think this is true in our day as well. You know, if you were to look at most debates, if you were to ask speak with a atheistic scientist about what is true and what is real about biblical truth, it's much easier to critique the messenger than the message. You're uneducated. You're ignorant. Therefore, your message isn't true. If I bring it to the academy, if I bring it to those in the liberal arts, well, you're uncultured. You know, we're trying to be progressive here. You're uncultured. If I were to take it into the pundit, he'd say, well, you guys are just hypocrites. You Christians are hypocrites. It's a lot easier to critique the messenger than it is to critique the message. But the problem is, a stupid, uncivilized hypocrite doesn't necessarily have an invalid message. It doesn't say anything about the message. The messenger really doesn't. God delivers his message through a donkey at times. But nonetheless, he receives a message from the Lord. He wants to know about the messenger. And he gets this response. They answered him, well, he was a hairy man with a leather girdle bound about his loins. And of course, that's enough. He says, he sounds like a wild man. That's Elijah, the Tishbite. Apparently, he's heard stories from his parents who had a lot of trouble with this wild man. He says, I know exactly who it is. So he sends an envoy. Well, go bring him to me. Fetch him. And this envoy is made up of a different group. It's a military envoy. Pick it up. Verse 9. So the king sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50. And he went up to him, and behold, he's sitting on the top of the hill. Elijah was sitting on the top of the hill. And the captain says to him, O man of God, the king says, come down. And let me rephrase this to kind of clarify what's going on here. He's really saying, O man who speaks for God, I speak for the king. And the king commands that you come down. Okay? Who gives commands? Let's say that a superior gives commands, right? And then we say, well, who receives commands? Well, the subordinate receives commands. So if the man who speaks for the king, we'll say that he's the king's representative, gives a command to Elijah, who speaks for God, we'll say God's representative. Ultimately, who is trying to order whom around? The king's trying to order Yahweh around. See, Ahaziah is through his representative, giving a command to the Lord. Now, how might Yahweh similarly demonstrate his authority over the king of Israel? What might be a proper response to this? Well, by causing his representative really to dominate the king's representatives might be a proper response. Notice what happens, verse 10. So Elijah replies to the captain of 50, if I am a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And then the fire came down from heaven and consumed him, and his 50. Says, well, that'll do it. Says, you know, this little showcase of force isn't very impressive to God. But, unfortunately, you know, the old John Wayne quote, we've mentioned it before, life is hard. It's harder when you're stupid. He decides, well, if the first captain and 50 didn't work, we'll just send another one. So here we go, verse 11. So again, he sent to him another captain of 50 with his 50. And he said to him, O man of God, thus says the king, come down quickly. Now, if you're a soldier in the army of Israel, this would be a good day to call in sick. Okay, these guys march back up to Elijah's hill. There's a crater of scorched earth over there. Okay, you can, with the last regiment's remains in it, you see the corpse of the previous commander just sitting right in the middle of it. And again, he comes up and he makes this demand. And again, I ask, if the Lord has revealed himself in a supernatural way, today, I would ask you, would it make a difference? You know, oftentimes I hear the complaint, usually from an arrogant intellectual fellow, that if God would only manifest himself supernaturally, you know, if he would provide me with enough evidence, then I would believe. I think of Bertrand Russell when asked, if you die, if you're presented with God, the moment that you die, and it turns out that you're wrong, what would you say to him? He would say, sir, you didn't give me enough evidence. Richard Dawkins, the scientist, was asked the same question. He said, well, I'd ask two questions to him. The first I'd ask is, which God are you? You know, Thor, Mithra, Baal, Yahweh. And then he said, I would ask, why did you go to such extent to make it so difficult for people to believe in you? You know, I don't think it takes long reading through the Bible to come across a multiplicity of individuals who've had God appear supernaturally, super intervene, and they didn't believe. That's not the problem with faith. It's not a lack of evidence. The problem, too, is when you have something like this happen, you have God super intervening in history, he changes your life, and then you go to sleep. You wake up the next day, you go to sleep again, and it becomes your memory. You have your memory is what you have. You don't have a constant present experience. You have a record of the history of your life, your memory, and that's all you got. And you're relying on this subjective experience, and at some point in your life, you begin to question it. Pharaoh, Ahab, Ahaziah. Look at the New Testament. Jesus is going around doing miracles right and left. How many people believed? 12? Well, 11. Right? It's not a problem of the Lord not revealing himself. It's a problem of a matter of the heart. They hate the Lord. So here comes this commander. And in spite of the fact that he's standing right by a crater of the previous people who tried this, he defies the Lord's representative once again. And once again, he's barbecued. So what does Ahaziah do at this point? Send another crew. He reminds me, I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with Futurama. It's this old cartoon comedy show. And there's a character in the show named Zap Brannigan, and he's made to be this, like, cliche space commander, kind of making fun of old space commander movies. And Zap Brannigan has become famous because he came up with the strategy to win the Great War against the Killbots, these robots that his people were at war with. And his strategy, he figured out that the killbots actually had a kill limit. And once they reached their kill limit, then they no longer were able to fight. So he would send wave after wave after wave of men until all the killbots reached their limit, and then they could win the war. Ahaziah is sending wave after wave of his men. Maybe the Lord's going to run out of fire to send from heaven. Maybe he won't be there this time. Maybe he'll be checked out like Baal was on Mount Carmel. So he sends a third regiment. Verse 15. He sent again a captain of a third, 50, with his 50. But when the third captain of 50 went up, he came and he bowed on his knees before Elijah. And he begged him. And he said to him, "O man of God, please let my life and the lives of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Behold, fire came down from heaven and consumed the first two captains of 50 with their 50s. Let my life be precious in your sight." He's got it right. He's got the chain of command correct. I know that I have an authority on this earth, and I've got to do my job, which means I have to come and I have to talk to you, but I recognize that you answer to a higher authority, okay, a true authority, and I submit to that authority. Please don't wipe me out. It's the right answer. And of course, by submitting to Elijah, by paying homage to the messenger, who is he paying homage to? The one that he represents. It's a story we've been really tracking from the beginning, right? We've been looking for that 315 one, that one who's going to replace the first Adam, the one who's going to represent God fully, the one who's going to rule, the one who's going to crush the serpent, fix things. And on the way, God has been sending representatives to speak for him to the people. So we saw priests and judges, kings, prophets. You know, you saw individuals through the story like Abraham or Moses, Joshua, these people that are standing and speaking for God, and to treat them as common is to treat the Lord as common, but to revere them reveals which team you're on. How you respond to the messenger relates to how you respond to God. This morning we were talking about Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is the psalm where we get the definition for Christ or Messiah. Or anointed, Jesus the Christ. So when John is saying, "Look, I wrote this gospel so that you'll believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you'll have life in his name," that's Psalm 2. Whenever Jesus is brought before Caiaphas, he says, "I adjure you, tell me, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" Psalm 2. Okay, in the psalm, we find that the Christ is the one, he is the one chosen by God who will represent him fully and rule over the world on behalf of the Lord. And the nations are in uproar against this anointed one. You know, they're devising a vain thing. They're saying, "How are we going to remove these chains from us? You know, the Lord is over us. How are we going to get away so that he's no longer the boss of us?" And he just laughs and scoffs at them and says, "Look, I've installed my king. And the choice that the kings have at the end is to either pay homage to the Son or be destroyed by his wrath." And the point is, how you respond to the Son, how you respond to the Messiah, how you respond to the representative dictates your relationship with the Father. And that's going to be the scandal of the New Testament when we get there. The scandal is that there is a people in the New Testament, they're called Judaizers, who think they have a relationship with the Father without the Son. And again, you're going to see the apostles who are standing in that spot as God's representatives who have his word. What we have seen, what we have heard, what we have touched, we proclaim to you. So the whole New Testament, when we're reading all of, we got to pay attention to these pronouns. We're going through the New Testament, through the epistles. The apostles are having to defend their spot, saying, "Look, we witnessed Jesus personally. We heard his words with our ears, and now you guys who weren't there to hear it, we're going to bring them and deliver them to you. And if you don't listen to us, you don't have a shot. You don't have a relationship with the Father. Because the only way to a relationship with the Father is through the Son. And guess what? You haven't seen him. We have. That's our situation today. Have you seen Jesus? Walked with him, talked with him, heard his teaching in Jerusalem? Mm-mm. We only have the apostles' words recorded, that apostolic testimony. And through faith in that apostolic testimony, we have a relationship with the Son. And by having a relationship with the Son, we have a relationship with the Father. That's where the story's headed. Now, all this, we're ending up Elijah's ministry here. Okay, this is the last encounter Elijah has. He goes with this particular commander. The Lord says, don't fear this guy. This guy reverences you and he reverences me. Don't fear him. Go with him. And he goes to Ahaziah and he basically tells him the same thing. I don't know why you've been asking me to make this trip over here. I've already sent you the message. You want me to say it again? Slower? I'll say it again. He relays the exact same message, and of course, Ahaziah dies shortly after. This is the end of Elijah's ministry. But you might recall, towards the end of 1 Kings, Elijah picked up a disciple, one who was going to succeed him in the prophetic ministry. His name is Elisha. Elisha. So you have Elijah, and then Elisha, the disciple. And we pick up with him in chapter 2. He's walking along with Elijah, and apparently Elijah's not going to be around very long. Because they're aware, verse 1, that the Lord was going to take up Elijah by a whirlwind. And Elijah tells Elisha, verse 2, stay here. They're in Gilgal. Stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. Okay, he's like, I'm going to be taken away in a whirlwind. My ministry is done. You don't have to follow me anymore. And Elisha's response is, look, as the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. And three times he's going to try to separate from him this way. He's going to try to separate at Gilgal, at Bethel, and at Jericho. And three times he's going to say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm stuck with you. You're it. I'm not leaving your side. And twice he's going to be approached by other prophets who tried to disturb him. And notice it, verse 3, you'll see some come up at Bethel. Then the sons of the prophets who are at Bethel, they come out to Elisha. They say to him, don't you know that the Lord will take you, take away your master from over you today? He says, I know all about it. Leave me alone. I'm sticking with Elijah. I'm sticking with God's representative to the end. And he sticks with him. And we find in verse 7 of chapter 2, they make it to the Jordan River. The prophets are overlooking them. Only Elijah and Elisha are moving forward, and notice it. 50 men, sons of the prophet, went and stood opposite at a distance while the two of them stand by this river, the Jordan River. And Elijah takes his mantle, Elijah does, and he folds it together and he strikes the waters, and the waters are divided. We're thinking of Joshua. We're thinking of Moses. The water is divided so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And they crossed over, and Elijah says to Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you. And Elisha said, please, let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. Let me represent God as well as you, and even better. And he says, look, you asked for a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I'm taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. You know, if you follow me faithfully to the end, if you see me taken up, if you stick with me, it'll be so. If not, can't help you. And as they're going along, notice it, behold, a chariot of fire and horses of fire which came and they separated the two of them. And Elisha goes up with a whirlwind to heaven. And Elijah saw it. He saw him depart and he cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel, its horsemen. And he saw Elijah no more. And he took hold of his own clothes and he tore him to pieces. And he also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him. And he returned and he stood by the bank of the Jordan, which is where we started. This broken prophet, the master that he's been following, who's been discipling him, has been taken away from him. The one through whom God's been working. The one who thought he was the only prophet of Yahweh in Israel. The one who had the truth. He's gone. So where's the God of Elijah now? Is he gone too? Is he through working in the northern kingdom since the northern kingdom has rejected him so continually? Verse 14. He took up the mantle of Elijah that fell on him, and he struck the waters and said, where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the waters, they were divided there and here. and Elisha crossed over. It wasn't about the representative. The same God is there. He's just changed who he's working through. The God of Elijah hasn't gone anywhere. And the question we ask is, well, where is the God of Elijah today? And where is the God of Abraham today? And the God of Moses? And the God of David? The God who does these miraculous works, who intervenes in such incredible ways in our Bible? Where is he today? When we have crazy things going on, we've never been as connected as we are now. You can turn on the internet and see all kinds of terrible things going on all over the world. Where is the God of Elijah? Where is he today? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we saw his glory, the glory as the only begotten Father, full of grace, full of truth. He came to his own didn't receive him, but to as many as who received him, he gave the right to become children of God. Where's the God of Elijah? It's not far from each of us. He was found by us who did not seek him. And he says, if you continue to seek, you will find me. He'll let himself be found. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Just like the same words that David says to Solomon applies to us as well, though. If you reject him, he will reject you. But the promise we have is Matthew 28. When we say, where is the God of Elijah? His words to the disciples, whose apostolic word we carry, behold, I am with you, even to the end of the age. That's even until I return. I'm not going anywhere. The apostles have moved on. The prophets have moved on. I've left with you pastors and teachers and evangelists and members of the church to work, to encourage, to build up the body. I'm with you. These guys are gone. They've served their purpose. They've left their word. Now he's with you. And just like his word to Elijah, do your job. His word to Elisha, do your job. His word to Paul, do your job. Paul's word to Timothy, Timothy, do the work of evangelist. That's your job. Do your job, Timothy. The same word goes out to us. We got to do our job. He has specially crafted you for the building up of his body and service in the present day until the end of the age. Let's be found doing our jobs. Kenny, Lynn, would y'all come up while we observe the Lord's table?